I'm Chilly Willy, frozen through and through. In honor of Disney Nature's penguins, what's your favorite on-screen penguin?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the Hugh Jackman Elvis penguin from Happy Feet because that is a strange movie and a strange performance.
I'm Matt Patches, and I am going to go with the penguins from Mr. Popper's Penguins, the Jim Carrey adaptation of a book from the, 1930s or something. It's actually pretty fun.
I'm David the Seven. I'm going with the OG Mary Poppins, Dick Van Dyke, dancing penguins because it is the best answer.
And I'm David Ehrlich. I love when we have questions where I have objectively the correct answer. And this week is one of those. I'm going with the lost penguin in Werner Herzog's Encounters at the End of the World, who wanders to his doom away from his penguin family. It is heartbreaking. It is hilarious. It is everything that penguins mean to me and you.
Can you say it in Werner Herzog voice?
I could try, but I need the exact quote because it's so perfect.
He's saving the accents for the iTunes reviews.
Double back. We'll double back.
They walk across Antarctica. No.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 254, and it's the week of Wednesday, April 17th. And on that day in 2011, a show called Game of Thrones premiered on HBO. I watched that episode or the subsequent episodes with a printed out family tree of the Stark family because I could not tell anyone apart.
That was important.
It was an important watching thing.
I mean, probably the second or third episode, and I was like, all right, if I'm going to watch this, I got to learn how to tell Robb Stark and Jon Snow apart, which I could not do.
Interesting. I definitely did not watch the premiere of Game of Thrones. I caught up like two seasons in. Dave, did you actually watch the premiere?
No, I was a...
You're a poser.
No, I caught up after the day after Baelor because, I don't know, we're not a spoiling podcast, but the big thing happens to Shad Bean in that episode. And I was like, that sounds like a daring show that isn't a boring fantasy show like I thought it was.
And we're not a spoiler podcast, but I think we're allowed to spoil something
events
that happened
from 2011.
Nope.
I think.
Okay. These penguins are all heading to the open water to the right, but one of them caught our eye. This one, in the center. He would neither go towards the feeding grounds at the edge of the ice, nor return to the colony. Shortly afterwards, we saw him heading straight towards the mountains, some 70 kilometers away. Dr. Ainsley explained that even if he caught him and brought him back to the colony, he would immediately head right back for the mountains. But why? One of these disoriented or deranged penguins showed up at the New Harbor diving camp, already some 80 kilometers away from where it should be. The rules for the humans are do not... And it just goes on. I think
iTunes review from Germany. Out. We appreciate that. Are there any other iTunes reviews, David?
There are.
I'll call you off guard.
Let's see.
You were too busy in Herzog land.
my Herzog accent could use some work. We have a hot one-star review from CMDM who says, don't bother. I am going to bother because you bother me, CMDM. I keep looking for a podcast about movies where the hosts are not boring, pretentious hosts who think everything they talk about is fascinating. I don't care about their personal lives. I want to hear insight and analysis of movies. This is not it. I'll keep looking. Well, like the penguin wandering in the opposite direction from the rest of the herd. You are walking to your doom, CMDM.
There's nothing we can do to stop you.
I think this listener may have started with the wrong episode.
Probably. To be fair, when there are 254 episodes, there are a lot of wrong episodes, I'd imagine, to start with.
Yeah, but I wouldn't recommend a quarter quell to people first.
Katie, were you about to say something like truly mind-altering, or should I continue with the segment?
No, please continue.
Jess
diminish a female voice.
I'm just, this is for the good of the podcast. I already did 30 seconds of Werner Herzog. That's my fault. Listening for years. This great podcast has helped me through the workday for years. Now I love all the hosts. Razbalam. Did we read Razbalam? The name's familiar to me. I feel like we may have.
That's your father's name.
I think that's when you went to Wonderland and met caterpillars and talking.
Well, this is relatively short, but it's an open-ended question. We'll start with Katie for makeup when I so rudely silenced her. Loved hearing all of your amazing New York stories last week or 2 weeks, depending on when you read this. And it made me look back on my first time going to New York last summer. As someone from LA, I was scared that it wouldn't be for me, but it ended up being one of the best, most meaningful experiences of my life. However, visiting New York and living in New York are two different things, and I'm wondering whether or not you all think about something. As a college student with a screenwriting degree and barely any money or internships to my name, would it be super irresponsible or a bad idea to move to New York right out of college? How long should I wait if I do move? Is there an age too old to be moving there for the first time? Very curious to hear your thoughts, Katie Rich, and thank you for reading.
Ooh. I think it depends on what you want to do. If you're trying to break in as a screenwriter, I don't think New York is the place to go, but there are other things you might want to do with your screenwriting degree. And if you have a burning desire to live in New York and no dependents and you're willing to live pretty cheap, do it, because then otherwise you'll regret not doing it.
That's very helpful. You could also live here for a year.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to stay forever.
My screenwriting degree didn't help me when I was in New York, but I did meet all of you and all the people that I work with now.
So were you trying to use your screenwriting degree when you lived in New York?
Yes, I was broke. I would have used anything for any job. I guess my point is, if you can, you know, comfortably take that leap of faith, I think the contacts that you get there will be useful if you want a career in entertainment. But I think that Katie's absolutely right. If you want to go straight screenwriting, those are staffed in LA, and it is just a benefit to get to know people there.
We have two quick more ones. Well, one on the
longer
side.
Wait, David, you didn't answer. Should he move to New York?
Well, I mean, that was really only intended for you to answer, because we have a podcast
the mother
here.
Dragons.
Yes. Francium says, I wonder how this will sound when David reads it. Well, Francium, let's find out together. Oh my God. Over 30 episodes, including two quarter quells. I know it's no MCU marathon, but why did I put myself through this, listening to nothing else until I was caught up with everything I'd missed or skipped over so much time? Did I really think it would help me write a better review? But okay, I love this show. That I stuck to catching up with this gang's last half year of banter is more of a testament to their appeal than my determination. Or what I like about their banter, rather. I'm a film enthusiast who mostly, if not entirely, listens to movie podcasts, partially to hear and keep up with a robust variety of opinions, but mostly because they make me laugh like nothing else does. I don't know. I guess being a movie nerd just obscures your sense of humor to the nth degree. Matt Patch is just saying no to Katie's countless rewatches of Elf. Or, more quotably, I would be the wife from Amore in Ready Player One's VR universe. Among many other quotes, just send me into the stupidest peals of fizzy, incredulous laughter. Also, there are a few other podcasts that make stray quotes like Fighting in the War Room does, and absolutely no one that milks them like David Ehrlich. I don't remember how I started listening to this podcast. I assume either it was because of that IndieWire article long ago where they asked everyone in the office what film podcasts I listened to, or someone from following David on Letterboxd. Anyway, keep on keeping on. P.S. I cannot wait for the live-action Lion King and Aladdin. This took a turn. Not because I'm going to see them. I'm not, oh. But because I'll get to hear the finale of this group's debate as they reach some our series finale around the Lion King, as they reach some consensus, or not, about why they're going to be bad. P.P.S. I'm sorry to hear about the passing of Draco Malfoy, in parentheses, that I'm adding now. We stan a real one. The Hedgehog, but even sorrier to hear nothing from this podcast about the death of Agnes Varda.
Wait, we did talk about it.
I think we said we were going to talk. No, David monologued about it at the very end of the episode.
Yeah, and a sign-off.
That counts. Because,
under not dubstep music. That's all I remember.
I think we can all agree, not only us on this podcast, but all film lovers out there, that Draco Malfoy had a greater impact on all of our lives than we ever could. Yeah, no, we should be deeply remiss that we did not devote an entire segment to Agnes Varda. Hopefully some other great icon of cinema will die soon and we can make up for that. Did I miss something somehow in my binge? PPPS, disregard everything after Hedgehog. I have now listened to episode 252. Hey! thank you for your words, David. I hope you were in fact the one who has read this review out loud on the show and not out sick or yet another goddamn festival I forgot existed. This review was very helpful in too many ways to count. And very, very finally, very quickly, before we move on, Mr. Snake says, eyes wide shut. Oh, boy. I don't trust anyone on Twitter. Okay, I have to say, every word in this, every first letter of every word in this review is capitalized. So just picture it kind of like a ransom note.
Is it a code?
I don't know. I don't trust anyone on Twitter without a check mark. Fun. Don't know why I like listening to y'all talking about movies. But it's my groove for some reason. ... And The Shining with Jack is an admission. That he filmed the moon landing for TV. ... All work. ... Apollo 11 work. ... A11. ... Kubrick used King's Book as a template. ... And I would like to see Dumbo. ... N64 GoldenEye. ... This review is very helpful in letting us know.
Thank you, QAnon. We appreciate you phoning in.
QAnon is real. Look out for Phoenix Rising in Washington soon or some shit. I don't know. Let's move on with the show.
GoldenEye 64.
Because I'm an uncool person, I found out that Donald Glover was going to have a movie on Amazon Prime from an Amazon Prime press release and not from seeing him at Coachella or watching the live stream of Coachella or anything having to do with
it. I read about it on Vanity Fair, just to be clear. There's a great article about the making of what we're about to talk about, a movie.
Well, because I am uncool, I also was celebrating my dad's birthday and not paying attention to any of this over the weekend. So I caught up with Guava Island on Monday, kind of not knowing anything about it. After I watched it, I was looking up some reviews. I knew that it had been kind of like the secret project that Donald Glover and Rihanna were doing together in Cuba. There had been photos of them on the set, and I think they teased it on Instagram. And, you know, knowing Donald Glover and his level of creative output.
You know Donald Glover?
I know him personally. I know. Knowing him and having, you know, hung out with him and Rihanna in Cuba. He has a lot of creative control over what he does. Basically, anytime he announces a project, you can assume that he has a great deal of control over it, solo being the big exception, I guess. And what it turned out to be is kind of a music video or a very short feature film with not much of a plot. It repurposes some of his recent songs, including This Is America, which is a big viral hit. Rihanna does not sing at all, which we will get into later. But it's kind of like beautifully shot, set on this fictional Guava Island about kind of a workers' uprising. If you're in a media company that's been unionizing lately, like Matt Patches has, you might relate to it. And I thought it was lovely and had good songs that I already knew, and then otherwise kind of pointless, and then also infuriating that it didn't have Rihanna do anything. I am kind of here for Donald Glover for whatever he does because it's usually more interesting than not, but this one did not. I couldn't really figure out what the effort led us to. And Patches, I'm really glad that you watched it so I can have someone to bounce this off of.
Yeah, interesting. I'm not like the biggest Donald Glover fan. I never got sucked into the cult of Childish Gambino. And this film opens saying it's a Childish Gambino film. So, you know, there's Donald Glover actor and Childish Gambino.
Although he said he's going to retire the Childish Gambino alias. So they are becoming less separate, I believe.
I see. Well, this one opens, and as you said, this is employing all the big songs off his last album that we watched music videos for, and they're not entirely repurposed, although Guava Island is directed by Hiro Murai, who directed some of those videos and directed a lot of Atlanta. Certainly the same style. Now it's just kind of like his Purple Rain or his Mamma Mia, where these songs get integrated. That might be the wrong description, but I kept thinking about like, yeah, this is his Mamma Mia, essentially. It's his jukebox musical.
Like getting to be in like a beautiful tropical location and make a movie.
Yeah. Well, no, that's exactly right. Like, I think the weird part about this movie is that it feels like cultural tourism in a lot of ways. I'm not exactly sure what the point of it all is that he didn't make in, say, for instance, the This Is America video. Just to give some background on what the film is about, if you haven't heard anything Katie and I had, I don't think you and I heard anything about this movie, so I kind of went in completely blind. So if you don't want to do that, maybe jump ahead or just go watch this thing. It's only 56 minutes and it's streaming on Amazon Prime. But at first I was like making a joke to myself that Guava Island sounded a lot like Gullah Gullah Island. And I thought it was going to be some Nickelodeon riff. But actually, it has a similar prevalence to Gullah Gullah Island.
And there's a lot of animation in the very beginning.
Yeah, there's a lot of animation.
Kids movie vibe at first.
It has this childhood, this kind of storybook quality. There's a lot of animation, and they take place on Guava Island, a fictional location where this kind of like magical realism to it all. And Donald Glover plays this guy, Denny, who is a musician who he just wants to throw a music festival. And his girlfriend is played by Rihanna, this girl, Kofi, and she sews for a living. The magical realism aspect of this is that there's magical bugs that make thread that everyone's
like,
making.
Like silkworms, basically.
Yeah, silkworms. There's what is the primer follow-up?
Upstream color.
Yeah, there's like an upstream color vibe to this movie in a weird way. Not many people will make that connection, but the worms go there for me, and it's like galaxy braining from there. But anyway, everyone on this island is being oppressed by this company called Red Cargo, and everyone has to basically live in service of Red Cargo, and Denny is a guitar player and a musician, and he has to go on the radio every day and sing about Red Cargo. But in their off hours, he wants to stage this music festival. And this is where Donald Glover is able to integrate songs like This Is America, because a lot of the workers are like, I'm going to make money and get off Guava Island and go to America. And basically his grand metaphor is, you know, everything is
America. It basically
America
turns
if you're
that
being
song
oppressed.
Into America from West Side Story.
Yeah, and it's a cool dance sequence, but none of it was made more sense or kind of transcended the music videos that came before it. And I think that's where maybe it feels just a little dead in the water, where it's like, what is the point of combining all this? But can I just read
this Pitchfork, this thing that Pitchfork just tweeted? It's a link to an article that I have not read.
Sure.
But I'm just
reading the headline.
I'm going to read this headline to you guys to chum the water, see what you have to say about it. They said that watching Rihanna stay a chronically underused talent as Donald Glover erects a monument to himself can be maddening.
So, yeah.
I mean, read that in their review after I'd watched it, and I said, like, that was kind of dead on with
that. Unlike Lemonade, Beyonce's Lemonade, which I think is an artistic pursuit. It's arty and weird and non-narrative, but still has lots of grand metaphors to make and iconography to pick up on. It can be unpacked. It can be discussed. And the music speaks for itself. And it's ebbing and flowing. I loved how cohesive and yet, pure and ballsy and artsy Lemonade was. Guava Island, you know, Katie, you mentioned that there's not a lot of narrative, but it's pretty straightforward. There is an arc and like,
yeah, it's a
I don't
want to
spoil what happens, but
narrative.
It's, yeah, like, exactly.
It's simple. I mean, I don't think it needed to be complicated. It's a 55 minute movie, but yeah, it's a straightforward
story. I agree with the Pitchfork review, which is there's a lot of self-mythologizing going on here. I don't know if it's like patting himself on the back or what's the point. What is Donald Glover doing to elevate his music? Does he just want to look beautiful with Rihanna against the Cuban beaches? He does. They do. I mean,
this is
like couples retreat, except for people we respect.
Wait, you've compared it to Upstream Color and couples retreat. I think he's really interesting because he had this time as being a comedian. He kind of has like made his way to being taken seriously as a musician. It was kind of like a joke rap career that it seemed like he had for a long time. And then when he does this and he's dancing in front of Rihanna and singing and like is a good singer and is a good dancer, but having her be there as his sounding board, like literally just watching him perform the entire time, it's bizarre.
They dance
it feels like a weird ego movie, even though if that's not what he intended.
What do we think? So this is, as we've mentioned, not the first of these music. I don't know what the technical word would be for them yet. These music movies that are sometimes made in conjunction with an album or promote an album,
like Janelle Monáe's
Afrofuturist Lemonade. Next week, I'm very excited for, because I'm the whitest person alive, is the Nationals one that Mike Mills made with Alicia Vikander.
Didn't even know that existed.
What do we think of this as a dawning form as a way to have challenging, sort of unconventional filmmaking, get it out in the world with fewer barriers and more exciting.
Well, what's kind of great about this being on Amazon Prime, and it is interesting that this is about kind of like a labor union strike. It's something that's on Amazon. But it's on there. It's something that you're subscribed to. It's 55 minutes long. You're not paying for it. Kind of the similar with Lemonade, which people did eventually pay for, but it was a new album, but it was on HBO, which you already subscribed to. Like, the fact that these platforms exist to put something out there that doesn't have to be feature length, that doesn't have to have new songs. I think it's a good use of a platform like Amazon Prime.
But I think it could push the boundaries of art. I'm like, it doesn't – something like Guava Island shouldn't be this conventional. I want Hiro Murai to make a movie. I want him to make a movie as weird as Atlanta and as visually clever as Atlanta. Guava Island mm-hmm. does look beautiful. I mean, the sequence I was describing where they sing and dance to This Is America in this kind of factory looks great, and the gliding camera movements are – you know, really exceptional, and just like I'm absorbed by that.
But it doesn't look as good as the original This Is America video.
No, because that is very sharp and pointed, and the dance moves and his faces are like coming out and just smacking you in the face. Like it's that is astonishing. And this is, I don't know, it just, it's a pleasure, but it's not Lemonade. That's what I kept thinking, that like, I want people to push boundaries. I want things to get weird. Even Janelle Monáe's kind of Afrofuturist experimentations are just so, and or like the costumes of her music videos, they're just going to great lengths because they know they're going to have a captivated audience for this stuff. And that's where Guava Island doesn't really compute. Like, it definitely feels like something that should play at Coachella. I'm sure if I were on a lot more drugs and I was outside sunbaked, that Guava Island would feel so cool, man. But
I would almost like it to be more experimental or like more conventional and have it be kind of like an island rom-com between Donald Glover and Rihanna. Yeah. That sounds great too.
Yeah, give Brianna more to do. Like, actually invest in the fact that you're making a movie. Give her equal part. Give her a song. Write something new. Make this Purple Rain, or make this a throwback musical with a Caribbean vibe. Like, there's so many things that you could do with this. At 56 minutes, it feels both like an experiment extended beyond its capacity and something truncated that could have given everyone involved more room. Like, I mean, come on, Letitia Wright is in this movie.
That's what I was about to bring up.
She actually has a really intriguing character. She's working at the factory. She's another seamstress, and she's trying to break free too, but her character gets lost in, I mean, again, the aura of Donald Glover's character. Everyone loves him because he plays on the radio. So everyone's just obsessed with him, and he becomes a martyr throughout this story. And you're kind of like, all these people have agency and they exist and they love music and they love Guava Island. Why do they not rise up against the Red Cargo? Why do they not, if they love the power of music, they don't show that at all. They just listen to Donald Glover. And that's a little odd. And yet, I'm not the biggest fan of his, and I like him in this movie. He does some like weird Jim Carrey slapstick in this movie.
He's got this whole like concert performance scene that's really compelling. It makes you want to go see him in concert.
I totally agree. Maybe I should go to Coachella. I bet it'd be a great fit there.
Everything is like upstream color at Coachella.
Love those Coachella pics.
Continuing the recent tradition on this podcast of not giving iconic French women directors the time that they deserve, we are talking about Claire Denis's High Life in a truncated segment.
You're slapping us.
Yes,
but we're also dedicating time to talk about Claire Denis's new film.
Listen, I'm a complicated man. All right, just roll with it. We're talking about High Life, one of the best films of this year. Fucking High Life, man. Who else has seen High Life? Give me a show of hands on this podcast where I can't really see anything.
I think it's Patches, like,
I can see
theaters.
You. I can see you in your apartment. Are you raising your hand? You're saluting me. But you're not raising your
hand. I tried to actually, I was going to ditch the Avengers junket and try and take my 5 hours to go see High Life. But it was too far away and LA traffic was really bad.
Fucking LA. Katie, no. Dave, no. Okay.
No. High Life is, I do not believe it is playing where I live.
We are at, yes, no, no, no. The High Life by Claire Denis. Claire Denis, one of the greatest filmmakers currently living. She has made so many great films. 35 Shots of Rum, Chocolat, Bois Travail, Trouble Every Day, etc., etc. Has now made her space epic, as of course she had to, and she made it in the only way that she could. It is a Claire Denis film to the bone, but the premise of it is, well,
written by Zadie Smith, right?
No, there was a time, not at all. There was a time when
really
she and Zadie Smith were like flirting with the idea of collaborating, and they just had very, very different approaches to material. It's Claire Denis is a, I mean, they're both, I mean, she and Zadie Smith, they're both singular talents in their own right, which I can imagine why that would be incompatible. But yeah, I mean, you do not come in and write a screenplay for Claire Denis, and I just can imagine that would be a very difficult thing because she has her own way of seeing cinema and movies. It's very fragmented, it's very elliptical, and that describes High Life, which is ostensibly a movie about set in the some sort of indeterminate future where a prison ship full of prisoners who are on death row has been shot into space, ostensibly to observe a black hole, which we ourselves have now observed, in a way, thanks to the photo that came out from NASA, but and to like do some sort of energy. But really, it's just an opportunity for the government to perform experiments on them. They are on a one-way suicide mission. None of this is... I mean, some of that is explicitly spelled out, but none of it is really dwelled upon. This is not, as is the case with many of Claire Denis' movies, explicitly about plot. It is more keyed into the blood, sweat, semen, everything else that's going on aboard this prison ship, where Robert Pattinson is one of the crew members, along with Mia Goth and Andre 3000, and a kooky mad scientist type played by Juliette Binoche, who, if you've heard about this movie, you've probably also heard has a machine, a little dressing room shaped black box that she refers to as the fuck box, where she masturbates, but not like violently, but not to the point of orgasm. That is something that Claire Denis would like to make very clear.
Thanks for clarifying, yeah. Claire Denis.
And I can see where the confusion would arise in that, in the way that Juliette Binoche thrashes about. But it's really sort of a story as it plays out mostly in flashbacks. When the movie starts, the only people alive on the ship are Robert Pattinson and a baby girl. And then we cut to flashbacks to see how it so happened that he was the only survivor on the ship with this baby girl who was not born.
Flashbacks to Fuckbox. Flashbacks. Is my new band name.
Exactly. Flashbacks to Fuckbox. Hashtag flashback to Fuckbox. Try saying that even twice fast. It's very difficult. But really it's sort of a movie about moving, you know, whether these characters are sort of moving closer to the core of human behavior or violating human behavior in some way. It deals with life on the brink of apocalypse and the things that we do to survive. It is very much a movie for capital letters, hashtag our times. It is immensely moving in the way that many of these films are, even if it's sort of unknowable in its way. Robert Pattinson's performance, as has become pro forma for Robert Pattinson, is extraordinary. Ditto Juliette Binoche, of course. But I think this movie is completely rapturous. It's definitely not, you know, as far as science fiction films go, this is reductive comparison, but it owes more to the pacing of something like Solaris than it does even other movies that have a similar sort of vibe, like Sunshine by Danny Boyle, or like the Alex Garland films, for example. It's definitely a little bit more fragmented and lethargic than that, and meditative, but really stunning, provocative piece of work, like only Claire Denis could make. I really can't recommend you see it highly enough if it ever comes to your neighborhood. It is a big screen experience, even though she's doing outer space on a budget. Although the analog tactile solutions she finds to problems that would usually be paved over with CG these days are brilliantly lo-fi and really transportive in their way, in a way that just some code and that plastic loss that comes with it might not be. But it's a really extraordinary movie.
There is a single theater here in Denver, it turns out, that is opening it this week. So I have a question for you. In terms of post-apocalyptic movies that make you think and deal with the core basis of human, you know, I don't know, the interactions between humans and all life. Am I going to feel depressed or like activated mentally coming out of this movie?
I mean, it's open to interpretation. I would say the latter.
Dave's emotions are open to interpretation.
I think the what the movie is doing and how it's doing it are ambiguous. I would say, without spoiling anything, that as bleak as this movie's philosophy is, I think that it's ultimately hopeful in a way that is hard to put your finger on if you haven't seen the film. I think the ending is really insane, but kind of optimistic in its own very confrontational way. The ending is really remarkable.
Take
it as a yes. I think especially by Dave's barometer, he will not come out of this movie feeling depressed. I think it, given the circumstances into which the story begins and where we are now, I think you're starting in the basement and sort of climbing out from there, even though, you know, because the flashback format plays into that, because you do see some very gruesome developments, but all of them are in the past that are building towards this more hopeful future. So, I think you would definitely, you'll definitely find it thought provoking in a way that doesn't make you want to slash your wrists.
I like that. Those are better than the other kind.
For our final segment tonight, you know, piggybacking off the joys of High Life, it sounds like it's a real fun movie-going experience. We're going to talk about something you should definitely see in double feature with High Life. Not an anxiety-inducing experience at all. Just kidding. It is. It's a headache and a half. It's called Her Smell by Provocateur. He deserves this title. And I mean this in a great – I'm glad this exists. I'm glad Alex Ross Perry makes these types of movies. He and I grew up just only 20 minutes away. We really have the same kind of sensibilities. We just would be fucked with, I think. When we see movies, we want to be completely shook. And Her
and
Smell,
his movie stars one of the stars from your favorite movie of all time, Aquaman.
This is true. Amber Heard does make an appearance in Her Smell. The rest of the cast is the whole movie is led by Elizabeth Moss, who's playing the lead vocalist of this punk rock band. I believe it's called Something She. It's definitely hard to tell in those opening moments what is going on, because people are yelling, people are high, people are backstage at a punk rock concert. And we are, I feel like we're sinking into quicksand with this woman, Becky something, who feels very Courtney Love-esque as she downward spirals while her career just explodes and she finds lots of success in this kind of, these two paths that she's on in complete opposition to each other seem to be tearing her apart. And that's kind of where we pick up. And I think in true Alex Ross Perry style, if you've seen his other films, I'm a big fan of Listen Up Philip, which got a very caustic rap a few years ago, very influenced by what Philip Roth novels and that sort of thing. Starring Jason Schwartzman, just like the dialogue is prickly, the characters are prickly, everything is prickly. And then he followed it up with Queen of Earth, which is, again, like if we're talking about headaches in movie form, I mean, that was just such a tumultuous experience. I guess it's a thriller. Maybe it's a horror movie. It was psychological and it got under my skin. And Her Smell just continues this trend that Alex has been on, and something we should talk about as we talk about what we thought of this movie, which is kind of in limited release. It's getting a very small release. You may never be able to see it in theaters,
well,
depending on where you live, but I think
it performed well in New York. And
I mean, come on, this is a movie distributed by Gunpowder and Sky. It's not going to get that far. Most people will probably
Hearts Be Loud, which Gunpowder and Sky released to the tune of about $2.3 million.
David, you're living the dream world.
It made it out there over time.
Hearts Beat Loud, I think, eventually played here. If I'm, yes, if I'm gonna
that is,
barometer,
that
it
is,
played for a long time last summer.
That is the barometer. I'm
okay.
Setting. I don't know if Her Smell will have those kind of legs.
Well, just like summer. Heart Beats Loud, it's a feel good movie that's gonna play all summer. Her Smell. What I was going to say was we should connect the dots between our feelings about this. You know, this is not a movie that you just buy into. It's not a, I watched it one evening. After a long day at work, and I walked out being like, I don't know if this was the smartest decision. I feel really awful. I mean, there's some highs, towards the end, and I don't want to spoil too much, but like, this is a tough movie to watch. And David, you got to interview Alex and talk to him a bit about like feeling maybe bad about the industry and that has to try and put this movie out and get people to see it. But I think it's a complicated situation, and I'd be interested to talk about how we all feel about his reactions to putting a movie like this out into the world that, you know, when we talk about Guava Island not being pure art enough, this is definitely pure. I mean, this is what Alex went out to make from what I could tell, just soaking it up and feeling horrible. Like, this is what he wanted, and this is a hard movie to get people to buy into. Or maybe I'm totally off my rocker.
Alex Rosberry is not one for compromise. I think if you read the article that I wrote about him, the interview that I did with him and members of the cast and Robert Greene, who's a major filmmaker in his own right, who's his editor, you will certainly get that sense that Alex is not super interested in compromising the kind of movies that he wants to make. But, I have come around and really feeling like Her Smell is his best film. I did not see it under ideal conditions first time around, and at one, I was zonked out of my mind tired on day whatever of Toronto, but the premiere was in a theater in Toronto, which is not especially conducive to, I don't know, seeing or hearing a movie. And the sound mix was very muddied. And in the first 20, I mean, this is a, you know, Patches is referring to the idea of this movie being like a headache. Keegan DeWitt's score, and Keegan DeWitt also wrote the music for Hearts Beat Loud, I should say. And worked with Alex for a while, but, so the movie is broken up into five discrete segments that each are in their own period of time. It's like five long scenes, all of them, well, four of the five of them.
Yeah, it's like Steve Jobs.
Right. It is a lot like Steve
Jobs.
So
much like
Steve Jobs. It's a reference point that they used. It really is. I mean, like, they just don't botch the ending. It's the biggest difference. There isn't like a Coldplay song or whatever. But and the first of those segments is meant to feel, his instructions to Keegan DeWitt were to make it feel like a panic attack. And mission accomplished. And when I saw it in Toronto, it was also a panic attack that you couldn't really hear clearly. It felt a lot like a Gaspar Noé film, which was maybe not quite the intention.
And there's a lot of deliberately muddied sound, like it's taking place in these punk clubs where you hear just like this like thudding apocalyptic noise in the background that has to be really precise that it doesn't just feel bad.
And that is the score. So it sounds like you're underneath a concert venue or something like that, but that is the score. And it can be, if it's not modulated correctly, it can again sort of put the experience off tilt. But it's a movie that I've really come around to and sort of reckoned with what it's about. I mean, in the idea of relying on other people, this is something that Becky Something's character learns, because this is really a movie, you get the sense that Alex empathizes less so with Becky and more so that he puts himself into all the people in her orbit, some of whom, I mean, the most interesting of whom are played by Gail Rankin and Agnes Dean, who are the other two members of her band, are really negotiating over the course of this 6 or 7 year period, the extent to which they are depending on her and she's depending on them, the extent to which they are responsible for her behavior and are trying to pull her out of this tailspin. It's a really sort of complicated fall and rise story that negotiates so much with what success means to these people and what they mean to each other. And I think that the more I watch it, the more I see what it's tapping into in the Riot Girl world where it comes from. I mean, I think in my initial review, I wrote something kind of tossed off about how there wasn't really a precedent for this character and beyond sort of Courtney Love. The biggest reference point actually for me was Phantom of the Opera, which is sort of a theme throughout the movie. It's a t-shirt she wears, but it's like Courtney Love meets Phantom of the Opera done as like Gina Rowlands would do it, maybe.
I feel like you've been working on that line.
I've written that line a few times. I'm not a good enough actor to make it sound like, or I've written something like that line. I think it's just, there are all these wonderful characters who all have this real sense of life between them. There's this whole other band of like these upstart girls who are a lot less troubled but idolize Becky and are coming up in her shadow and eventually overtaking her, called the Acre Girls, who are played by Cara Delevingne, Ashley Benson, and Dylan Kalula. Agnes Dean, it just gives like such an amazing performance. You got Eric Stoltz as the record label owner.
He rules. He's so good in this movie.
You got Virginia Madsen.
She's really good in this movie.
Always good. You have a scene where Elizabeth Moss performs all of Bryan Adams' Heaven on a piano in one take, which is phenomenal. There's a lot to love about this movie. And I just think that like people assume, particularly people who have only been watching from the sidelines casually, that to make a movie like Listen Up, Philip, you have to be like Jason Schwartzman's character in that movie. You have to be this asshole. And I'm not going to sanctify Alex, but I do think that there is a lot of heart to this movie. There is a lot of love between these characters. There is a really, I mean, it is an endurance test to get through those first 80 minutes or so. I mean, the movie really follows you. She's a sinking ship of a woman and it follows you to the fucking bottom of the ocean. But
well, Katie, I have a question for you before we get to more macro stuff. Like, there's a lot of child endangerment in this movie, and I thought of you, and I'm like,
I mean, it made me grateful for being a sane and stable person. Like, even in my, you know, worst moments, I'm not taking a kid and running around a punk club drunk.
I just feel
you're
bad that you had to give up your rock career.
Becky something of podcasts.
I mean, so I've been able to watch this movie on at home, which I think is the way a lot of people aren't going to be experiencing it. But I felt like the panic attack aspect of the beginning for me was so offset by what Elizabeth Moss is doing. Like, I find her so captivating and all the choices that she's making and the extent to which this performance can go. You know, I've known people and like maybe not that bad, but like people who have aspects of that personality. And in real life, they're just as maddening as all the people around her are making her out to be. But you don't see performances like this very often. Like, it just felt like every choice she was making felt real to this person who was so off the wall. And I was so drawn in by that, even if the idea of being in that room was a total nightmare.
Well, her dialogue is super colorful, too. There's this, like, Shakespearean streak.
Kind
of the middle section of the movie, they're trapped in this recording studio. And she's just going off at the young band. And the dialogue that she's spitting is so percussive, like the words are manic and her behavior is unhinged, and it's just like a delight even as she's flaming out, you know. It's like
I just that, like hearing words scene like that in Vice, but it's like a real scene.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Well, so my big question for everyone is kind of based on what Alex said in David's profile, just about like, I guess, being disheartened by the industry, knowing that it's going to be so hard to do this kind of movie that, I mean, David, tell me if I'm off base in paraphrasing here, but like that there's not support for this kind of movie, that there's it's so difficult. And it's like, he basically has to con his way into making it. It sounds like, to convince someone that this could be mainstream. And then, you know, A24 shows up and they're like, we're not going to put this out. No, we don't see potential here.
I mean, it's
people who
wild.
Take risks. And I just think it's interesting that even the risk taker distributors that people flock to wouldn't take a chance on her smell. And at the end of the day, I'm like, I kind of understand it. This is the hardest thing about movies as art, that they cost so much, and the commerce of it makes making an artful movie, something that is pure, very, very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild when you look at the ridiculous cast in this movie. I mean, all these people work for scale, but it's such a stacked cast. You would be able to make character posters, you know, if this movie had a $50 million marketing budget. You could do character posters for like 15.
Avenge Becky something.
Yeah, like 15 different people. Exactly. It's the kind of movie that you could see. I don't know. It is really difficult. It is a movie that, I mean, he wrote a really interesting article that you should read on the Talk House, where he was talking about the financials of this movie in relation to Paul Schrader's First Reformed. And just like, you know, there's something that he actually doesn't say in the article, but that he said to me a couple times, which is this Paul Schrader, idea that he's encapsulated, is that like people really only have the bandwidth to focus on one independent American film per month. And if you are not that movie, you don't get the eyeballs you need to survive and not be underwater. And right. this month, that movie is going to be whatever it is. But like, you know, there's one. In 1 month, it's I'm trying to think of independent films that have done well recently. It's hard.
This is your job.
And without the Oscar machine behind you.
Right.
It's difficult. I mean, but this movie only costs significantly less than $3 million. It was bought for significantly less than that. And it probably won't come close to hitting. Hearts Beat Loud again is Gunpowder and Sky's highest grossing film, made $2.3 million. Her Smell would be very, very, very lucky to get over two. It's a difficult market.
So you say that it's not going to have the Oscar machine behind it. I find it crazy that people aren't talking about awards for Elizabeth Moss right now. And I know that saying that in April is obnoxious, but like that is how movies like this can really.
Don't you have a whole podcast that does this?
We had Alex Ross Perry on our podcast last week talking about Her Smell.
Her name will come up. I hope so.
Like, I feel like people need to start talking about it now to make sure that it keeps happening.
People won't sit through this movie. I think that's the problem. That it's like such a headache in a way that is intentional and is designed to make the conclusion of this movie. If you can cross the threshold of where Her Smell goes, then the payoff is momentous. But
you know, Alex doesn't really believe in the idea of walking out of a movie. I mean, like, I was talking to him about this, and he was saying that the idea to him that someone would watch 80 minutes of a movie this is an 135 minute movie, by the way. And it needs to feel like you're covering this and canvassing this very long stretch of time. And it's long enough for characters to have these, momentous transformations, but that someone would sit there for 80 minutes and then be like, yeah, you know, I'm good. And I'm going to leave and not stay for when the worm turns and things starts to rebound is sort of insane to him. And I think you need to have that mindset if you're going to make a movie that spirals as vertiginously as this one does.
Dave, let me ask you a question. So you are all encompassing because people on this podcast probably know you best for like loving mega franchises and being in deep on like big, big populist mainstream movies. But you have in your New York days when you were putting that screenwriting degree to good use, producing really low budget independent film. When you hear someone like Alex Ross Perry say that, like, I'm not going to be compromised, I'm going to make the film that I'm going to make. And it just seems, at least in the interview with David this time around, it's like, this could be my last movie. Who would let me make another movie that's not going to make money and I'm not going to be compromised? Do you hear that and think like, make concessions, like bend over backwards, I just wonder if the definition of art for everybody here is fluid enough that compromise can be part of it when film is so driven by commerce and the decisions to like what gets a movie made ends up being a commerce conversation also. I don't know how you feel about that.
I mean, having listened to you guys describe it for like 10 minutes, I would say like, no, the correct decision is the decision that was done because it sounds like this movie, you know, is correctly using its expression and form and sounds pretty sure in what it's saying. And if that's not palatable, those sorts of decisions should be talked about between the money people and the creatives before you start, or at least like, or even with investors, if you think it's going to be that sort of thing, where it's like what you're investing in is this person's vision. You're not investing in a monetary product,
That's not been Alex's problem. I mean, like this is confusing. Gunpowder and Sky put the movie out, but Bow and Arrow, another plus company, financed the movie, and they bought into the vision that he was selling and were very hands off and let Alex have final say over everything he needed to.
But the question is, would they again?
You can't sacrifice. I mean, I think that they would also say that, like, you know, if you're rolling the dice on these types of investments, you can't sacrifice your belief just to try to get distribution. Like, I think that, you know, the talking about, you know, keeping Elizabeth Moss buzz going for Oscars early as a way of getting the scene films good. It releases here Avengers Endgame weekend. So if you want some intense counter programming in Denver, Colorado. You can see Film Center.
Like an hour shorter than Avengers Endgame is. So,
well, if you're just judging by time,
and it somehow might be like, less of a headache in the end, but
oh, much.
There's also a part of me that, you know, loves watching Gaspar Noé films, or then like endured a Serbian film Red Band cut that was never supposed to be on Seaside. And they're about pushing those boundaries in filmmaking and storytelling, and I think those are worth it. And yeah, I would try not to, as a responsible screenwriting degree holding producer of independent film, cut anybody back and say do this for distribution. I think that's a dumb time to do things.
I guess that's why the punk scene is not as vibrant as it once was. The punk scene in movies is non-existent, except for Smell.
I mean, I feel like the movie's ethos is, and the spirit under which it was made, is more punk than the subject matter of the movie, which is probably better classified as like a Riot Girl sort of. I mean, these are all sort of semantic distinctions, but I think anyone
gone deep on Riot Girl. You've had an awakening.
I think my knowledge of Riot Girl does not really go much deeper than La Tigra and the fact that, one of their albums was incredibly formative for me, but, that's neither here nor there. But I do think there is sort of this punk attitude to the way that Alex approaches making movies, and it's less rebellious than it is just sticking to his guns and knowing what he needs and proving time and again that he can pull it off at a budget with this group of people. And being told, as people try to sort of grab him up the ladder, and we have the system where when you are a successful indie filmmaker, the idea is that you graduate into making bigger films where you are not given the tools to do the things that made you successful in the first place. You go and direct a Marvel movie, you go and direct some other studio movie where they say, okay, the editor that you've always used, he can't come, and your cinematographer, she can't come, and your set designer, they can't come, and the cast, and so on. And he's just like, well, I know how to make a movie. I know how this works. It's out of his hands of whether or not it makes money, but he knows that. I mean, it's amazing to me that you can look at this movie and see how much he gets on screen for how little it costs. And that's true across the board. I mean, you look at, I saw Little last week and I was astonished at how fucking ugly that movie is. It cost $20 million, which is not that much for a comedy, but I mean, it looks like you could have made it on your iPhone for $15. And it is one of the ugliest shot movies I've ever seen. And an advertisement to stay the fuck out of Atlanta, which looks just like a,
I don't know. I feel like you're insulting High Flying Bird here when you say that.
High Flying Bird looks great. I mean, High Flying Bird is one of the, nail in the coffin for something like Little. But then you look at like The Shape of Water, which also cost $20 million, or Us, which also cost $20 million. And it's like, well, when you have people who know how to use that money, you don't need to spend $100 million on a movie. You don't need to spend $50 million on a movie. You just need to make these movies intelligently. And then you can have people have bigger marketing budgets for them and pay more to acquire them and so on. And you can restore some sort of semblance to a mid-budget market. But yeah, I think that right now it's difficult.
Bemoaning the mid-budget theatrical market. It's Fighting in the War Room, part 254.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter for some reason, at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share with them, or you can, tell us what mid-budget, mid-level film that you're watching. Maybe not Little.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all the shit I write, including that interview with Alex Ross Perry, including a interview with Robert Pattinson for High Life, including an interview with Rihanna for Guava Island. Last one's not true. On IndieWire, you can please leave us a review on iTunes, where, as this week's episode proved once more, not for the first time, I will read literally anything you write. Please don't exploit that. But if you do, we won't know until it's already too late.
The best type of warning. I'm Dave Gonzalez, spelled my first name D-A-7-E, which is also my handle on Twitter, where you could follow my thoughts about things and links to my pieces at Thrillist.com about Game of Thrones, or Polygon.com about Game of Thrones, or my podcast, Star Wars Spoilers, about Game of Thrones. For 5 weeks, this will be my plug on this show. I apologize, but Game of Thrones.
Don't apologize. I'm Katie Rich. I'm at VanityFair.com, where you can find a lot of coverage of Game of Thrones from Joanna Robinson, who everyone always wishes was on this podcast as well, as do we. She's also on the Little Gold Men podcast that I'm on, and you know who else is there? Alex Ross Perry. You're not the only one who gets to talk to him, David. And he had a great conversation with Richard Lawson about what he learned writing Christopher Robin at the same time as Her Smell, which is a fascinating thing to think about. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. And we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where you should tell us if you made it through Her Smell or just answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Disney Nature's penguins, what's your favorite on-screen penguin?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.